Today, I'll be speaking to the one and only Hugh Hendry about the relationship that he sees between gold, silver, and real rates. Then I'll be speaking to Weston Nakamura about some dislocations that he's seeing in the VIX futures markets. But first, I'm going to be speaking to Real Vision's own Max Wheathy about the stories of the day. Max, welcome to the Daily Briefing. How are you doing?
Doing well. I know we've got other people coming up, so we're going to keep it short and sweet.
Yeah, this is going to be a lightning round with you. Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway recently filed their 13F. That was yesterday, I believe. What can you tell us about that, Max?
Well, I mean, the big one for me was, you know, the dropping of Barrick Gold. Obviously, gold is down today, and Barrick leaving Barrick being added to their portfolio was touted as this, you know, evidence that Warren Buffett like loves gold, or, you know, is starting to get gold. One, like the size, like Buffett doesn't make purchases of that size. If, you know, Buffett makes the big, huge, you know, multi-billion dollar purchases. So I don't think Buffett had anything to do with that purchase in the first place. But it's the way that, you know, narratives are spun. Like, I think it's just another great example of like being cautious. You should be cautious about narratives and remember who's saying things and why they're saying them. Because I that didn't pass the smell test for me originally. And yeah, so I mean, that's the big one. I think they added some Verizon, which they had trimmed earlier in the year. So a little bit of a reaffirmation of that bet. But, you know, that was the main one I was watching. Looked like they cut some financials. They added one insurance company, but, you know, cut some of their other financial holdings there.
Yep. I believe they exited JP Morgan entirely, which is significant. They had trimmed it earlier. And they also cut their Apple stake. Although that's not as significant as the headline sounds. People say, oh, he sold Apple. But really, they're just trimming their position because they still own about $120 billion worth of it.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of what I'm talking about when I say like narratives. Like, it's a great narrative to say like Warren Buffett like sold his Apple, but like $120 billion, that's, you know, still pretty confident there in Apple's future. So, you know, I would just tell everybody to be cautious about these sorts of headlines and narratives, because often there's a reason, whether it's clicks, whether it's supporting your own positioning or your portfolio, if it's coming from, you know, say a gold bug. It's just remember why you're hearing it, who you're hearing it from.
Yeah, as always, do your own research, folks. Let's move on to the next story, which is the storms that have engulfed much of the middle of the United States, particularly Texas, forcing rolling lockdowns on the state. Max, what can you tell us about that, as well as the energy implications that are perhaps behind it?
Look, I mean, as far as, you know, boots on the ground, I'm probably not the right person to tell you exactly what's happening in Texas. I know we have a team slowly growing in Dallas, and I'm sure they could tell you horror stories about what's going on there. And then obviously some people in Austin too. We've had to cancel interviews. We hope to have some interviews with some people who are based in Texas this week we've had to cancel. So, you know, it has certainly affected us, but really in terms of what I'm taking away from it is more big picture stuff, which is, you know, I talked to Sean Hackett earlier this year, who was talking about a bullish view on commodities. A lot of people have been bullish on commodities. It's been because of inflation and inflationary concerns. He has a completely different take, which is that there are supply disruptions. And obviously supply is determined by, you know, the crop production, which is largely driven by weather. And he was saying we're gonna have a cold winter, we're gonna have extreme weather volatility, and that's gonna be bad for crops. So at least though, so far that seems to be working up. But again, it comes back to that narrative stuff that I was talking about earlier, which is, you know, the narrative and what's happening and are not always tied together. But then thinking more long term, like not a little bit. I mean, this is drastic cold weather and serious, but, you know, we're supposedly going to electrify the entire, you know, everybody's going to have electric cars. How much electricity is that going to add to the grid? And look what, you know, this weather has done to the grid in Texas and the inability to produce enough power there. You know, I'm sure Adam Rodman is pacing back and forth in Dallas in the cold saying, if only they had listened to me, you know, nuclear fixes this. So just thinking about this as an example of longer term trends that, you know, electrification and commodities like copper that are going to be needed. You know, there's just another data point, evidence that we're not even close to where we need to be in terms of having the grid ready for all the electrification that is supposedly coming in the future.
Definitely. And with regards to facts mattering more than narratives, there's been a lot of narratives being bandied about, oh, this is solar's fault, this is wind's fault. Oh, no, actually, it's natural gas's fault. I think the reality is just the grid is not built for such extreme weather. And I'd also add that a lot of people see that we've seen enormous price increases in oil and natural gas, and they say that that's inflation, when it obviously is from exogenous events such as, a storm is not going to be here for 5 years, and that shouldn't affect the five-year break-even inflation rate. And yet you hear some people saying it does. But just to give a little facts to this story, the Texas power grid generally was requiring about 70 gigawatts. 42 of those gigawatts were offline as a result of the Arctic frost. And also as a result, about 40% of U.S. oil production is now offline. And you see the WTI surging well beyond 60 into about $61.50 now. So you are seeing how that story is affecting prices in the real time.
Yeah, and I would say less the story affecting prices, but that's an actual supply disruption there. And natural gas. Sean, in the previous interview I mentioned with Sean Hackett, he was extremely bullish on natural gas because of this hard winter. I don't think he was expecting something this extreme. But it really matters in physical commodities. It's a supply and demand story.
Absolutely. Max, switching gears again, the GameStop hearings commenced today, the congressional hearings in D.C. What do you make of those?
Yeah, I think everybody highlighted, how humorous it was that Roaring Kitty used the phrase, in short, I like the stock. Which people say, that's all the cover you need on, say, the sell side to be able to justify your shameless pumping of a stock because you want to get, their next capital raise through your investment banking arm, whatever it may be. And look, that's all well and good. Like it's super funny that he's able to do that. But I would like the conversation maybe to shift into the idea that that's all it takes to defend shameless pumping. Like the conversation needs to shift to like this has exposed broken aspects of the system. But I want it to shift from sticking it to the man to reforming the broken system. And I've had a little bit enough of the stick it to the man stuff that's happening there. And then as well, GameStop Robinhood came out and they said that they did not, favor hedge funds over their clients. I think that is true. Again, narratives really got away from themselves here in this and it has lasting effects and oftentimes, negative effects for people who cling to those narratives.
Very interesting, Max. I have some things to say about that, but we're going to have to move on to Hugh Henry now. Thanks again, Max.
Thanks, Jack.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Hugh, welcome back to Real Vision. It's great to have you.
It feels like just the day I was talking, the other day I was talking to Raul. Great to be back.
Yeah, you had a conversation with Raul about Bitcoin on Twitter Live. That got pretty intense. Now this is going to be a little bit more of a mellow chat, just talking macro as well as to talk about a new project that you've been working on. So Hugh, I just want to ask the ultimate question for macro investors, which is, how are you feeling about rates? You know, when you came on with Rao in April of last year, rates were gyrating all over the place. The 30-year was very low. They were reaching, you know, record lows. Now rates have continued to increase. I know, Hugh, you've been looking at TLT. So how are you thinking about rates, and how is the rising affecting risk assets?
Okay, so like you said, the last time rates were on their ass, around about 50 or 60 basis points. Much has changed, much hasn't changed, but certainly those rates. Where are those rates now? 1.3 or so?
Yep.
Now, that has implications clearly for almost every asset class. In the absence, and it has been the absence of inflation for, you know, the much anticipated inflation of the last 10, 15, 20 years, gold has kind of moved kind of in lockstep in terms of, and it's gained, do I want to say, a convexity or an optionality to the notion of the situation spiraling kind of out of control and into the notions of deflation, which is to say lower bond yields have been good for gold, and gold has kind of moved as real rates, taking, you know, long rates and then accounting for expected inflation, have been pushed to historic wides, historic negative wides. So what is changing? Jared, what was for you, what was the most important macro event of the last week or so? I won't give you time to answer that because I put a stopwatch for all of those of you who insist that I'm verbose. You're probably right.
Oh, wow. The interviewee has become the interviewer. I know there was a retail sales number out today at 5.3%. That was important, but by your groaning, I gather not.
It's so unimportant.
Hugh, could I turn the issue back on you? What do you think?
Yeah, so I have no idea, but the thing that made me kind of sit up and think was the report, the annual results from L'Oreal, the cosmetics company, last week, who claimed that we're all set, almost a bit like the Prince song, we're all set to party like it's 1999, albeit they referred us back to 1919, which is kind of cute because, of course, that was putting the back of the last awful virus, major pandemic virus, clearly much more severe in its fatalities. But the record, the precedent, and I'm a precedent person, and from back then, from time gone past, people partied, people kind of, there was just a pent-up release. And people, and I'm seeing that. I live in a kind of party place. I live in a grown-up Disneyland, a fantasy place. And people, when they get here, they just want to let it rip. And I can see it in my reservations calendar. So I kind of think, what do I think? I'm gonna share my screen. God forbid if we pick up some porn or whatever. But it was clearly not me. It was my son or whatever. And I'm trying to find good old barcharts.com. There we go. This is simplistic, but you know, this is going back to about 2010 or so, and it's the long term positive chart in the ETF for the long bond. And this, you know, you. In a bull market, you'd be looking for retracements. You'd be kind of looking to buy it maybe right about there, and it's kind of not capturing it. And I'd probably come back to here, this level, whatever it is, 130, let's say. We tried a breakout back in 14, 15, we failed. We tried another breakout, we failed. And then, you know, the real thing with the pandemic in front of us, boom, you know, the thing moved. So back here, I get a rational bull of someone who was fearful of deflation would be thinking I could pick up treasuries. But with that L'Oreal statement, and with we're going to kind of put layers of makeup and we're really, really going to party, I'm beginning to think now that it's going to come to a level. I don't think 120 would be too easy. It's going to get to a level where classic bull markets have to kick all the believers. You know, I keep going back to the disciples in the garden of whatever it was, and like, hey, the centurions are saying it. You know this guy Jesus, the guy with the beard, and like never heard of him, you know. And I think we're going to have one of those Garden of Gethsemane, whatever it's called, moments where we should say it could probably trade in that kind of 100-110 area. Now clearly that is idle speculation on my part, but I like to believe, I like to create notions of drama and then kind of ask myself how I would think. So I think it's going to be really, I think the economy is going to boom. I think those long rates are going to be under enormous pressure. I don't believe that bull market is over, but I believe people will be led to believe it's over. So that's my thought experiment, if you will.
Okay, so interesting. You think short term or maybe near term, there could be some pain in the treasury market. Hugh, I'm just thinking it's sort of over the last decade, where we've had strong economic growth and low deflation, what you wanted to own was bonds and you wanted to own tech. I see that both neither of these two assets will perform well in your new party reflationary world. So you want to own the cyclicals, your cruise liners, your energy servicers. What else is in the Hugh Henry portfolio according to this thesis that you just laid out?
Well, there's nothing in the fantasy portfolio because all of my activities are centered on the island. And I think it's worthwhile, making that very, very transparent. But it is the mining complex, it's the commodity complex. And for that extends actually to Bitcoin, and which is to say the assets that in the last 4 months have just been like a skyrocket. And it's a profoundly difficult and compromising position today because Raul was kept calling me a mean reversion guy. Like, he's like this funky S-curve guy. I'm just this boring mean reversion guy. But, so it may be. My compromise, so I find the movement has been so stark in the last, especially the last 3 months, that I don't really want to commit everything. So again, let me push back. If normally I had 100% equity allocation, then I would, today would be somewhere like a third of that. Given risks, et cetera, given valuations, et cetera. So of that third, so let's say I had a $100 million portfolio, I want to put $35 million to work, okay? But today, actually, I'd only be putting probably about $15 million. I'm trying to flesh this out. And I'd have positions in mining stocks. And I've been out there talking about uranium and silver. Gold is really, really tricky. So we have this thing called Bitcoin to come back and quote from Bono and U2, Bitcoin is like a thief in the night, see the world by candlelight. And it's robbing, and it's robbing someone, and it's robbing gold. Like I said to you, gold has historically, this recent history has moved in lockstep with real rates. Real rates had a bit of a gyration in the last 4 months. Where real rates are today, I think gold should be trading at around about 1950 or so. It's not. It's trading about 100, 150 less than that. If you were to put that into the capitalization, there's a lot of focus today on the size of the gold market and the size, the comparative small size of Bitcoin. So gold, I think, is $13 trillion and Bitcoin is closer to $1 trillion. But I want to say the movement in Bitcoin has been gold's not trading at 1950 because all of that money I want to allege has gone in to Bitcoin. Now, people are hearing me with Raul and some of my comments. They think I would be short for choice. No, I wouldn't. Short things which are powerfully exploding higher. I would be long, but again, I'd be long in terms of if I wanted to have $100 million, I'd maybe have $15, $20 million. I want the capacity to be able to buy this if volatility moves both ways. So I hope I'm not confusing you, but that's what I'm thinking.
Hugh, you're making perfect sense to me. So let's say that's your $100 million portfolio. Obviously, when you're working with a portfolio of that size, you're really aiming to protect that wealth. Someone like me, who's, let's say, trying to be a little bit more of an entrepreneurial investor, a little bit more of a hustler, take a little bit more risk, is it calls on those gold miners? What's the play there?
Oh, I mean, hey, listen, with junior mining stocks, all you're buying is convexity. You don't need call options on top. I mean, things like Denilson in the uranium sector, I think that went up 55 times in the last bull market. So you don't. And when I was talking 100 million or 100x, 100 apples, whatever, I wasn't talking about my portfolio. I was talking about a hustling type portfolio, a portfolio that wanted to kind of go out there and light up, write its name. My thing today is I believe the wisdom is written, is the graffiti written in the subway walls. That's when you're reading my stuff on Twitter, that's kind of what I'm aiming at. And that's what, so the hustler portfolio, I think I would just urge all you hustlers out there just to kind of, we can always see points A to B and we think, oh, if it goes to B, I'm going to be so rich. But the fact is not many people are rich, as rich as that. And the reason is that the journey tends to be, oh shit, why did that happen? And actually, I've never heard of this guy called Jesus. Never.
Yeah. Well, Hugh, you mentioned Subway and the Walls. I think that's a great transition to a new project that you've been working on, which is a short film, which we actually are going to air on the Real Vision YouTube channel. It's called Psychotic Cacophony. And Hugh, can you describe what this film is about? And as you talk, we're going to include some footage from that project on screen.
Wonderful. Well, that's very kind of you guys and girls at Real Vision. I put it out on my YouTube channel about 2 months ago, and I was such an idiot because it's something that needs an explanation. Visually, I think it is quite stunning, apart from the sections with me, but what I'm trying to convey is I'm trying to convey my life's journey. Not that I'm at the end of my life, but I'm kind of at a point where I want to put it in perspective and celebrate it. And the fact is, I had the weirdest childhood, not necessarily a child, but as an adolescent. I didn't smoke, I didn't drink, I didn't do drugs, I didn't do girls, I didn't do anything except study. Study was a kind of passport for me to try and kind of escape the chains that I felt were weighing me down. And I felt that I lived in a gray world. And so the first section is very much that grayness. I mean, I looked out my bedroom window and it was unchanging. It was gray, but my imagination, I was kind of had a colorful imagination. I could see things and I had the foresight and the wisdom to see a world where I was kind of unchained and elsewhere. Second section is, I then got lots of serendipity, lots of kind of breaks. I like to think you kind of make some of your good fortune from hard work. Found myself working in Edinburgh, found myself working with people with impeccable standing, impeccable logic, gave me a wonderful training, but it was just a meeting, a clash of cultures, if you will. And I had this strange sensation whereby I felt the vibrations of change, but they weren't teaching me how to manage or to embrace and really make money from them. And the final section is when I met the crazy people, this takes us back 20 years. Hedge funds were still a kind of an alien concept. And when I met with Crispin Odey, and he's talking about pirates. And
to interrupt. Crispin Odey, he was the one who started talking about pirates. It's not you, because I always associated the word pirate with you.
I owe so much to Crispin. The term eclectica comes from Crispin. He looked at my portfolio. And, back in the day, I owned stocks with the name Plantation. In the year 2000, trust me, no one owned stocks with the name Plantation in it, or indeed junior mining stocks, or owned soybean futures. Maybe not year 2000, but certainly year 2002. My portfolio looked like this curiosity shop from Victorian age. Think of like the Rolling Stones doing that kind of circus cabaret of lunatics. That was the office of Vody. We misbehaved like big time, like misbehaved in terms of the color and the crazy things that we were willing to believe and invest in. And that's what that final section is all about, that, the crazy people taught me to embrace change, and that power allowed me to launch the hedge fund. And then we take it to this, what proved to be my summit. I had about $1.5 billion under management. But I had been forced to compromise, and the pirate had become kind of a Royal Navy stiff.
I was about to bring that up, yeah.
Yeah, I'd become a stiff. It was the best of times, potentially, financially, and yet creatively, it was the worst. So that's kind of, if you will, the three sections of my life. But I'm not dead. I'm intending to live a bit longer. And so I'm invigorated, and I'm here sharing this story. I want to share this story with you because I live underground. My message is very much underground, and it's very much written loud on subway walls. I am the graffiti anti-investor.
Now, curiosity is different. It's different for everyone. For me, it's rock, it's roll, it's peace, it's everything. Perhaps, maybe just that's why I talk in extremes.
Faith?
You mean the demons, the voices in my head?
We love it here at Real Vision. Hugh, thanks for sharing your journey. You just saw some of short film on screen to the people at home, but again, it will be on our YouTube channel and you can check that out. Hugh, so great to have you on Real Vision as always. Hope to have you back soon to pick your brain on, you know, Bitcoin, gold, silver. Hugh, we didn't get to talk about silver. I want to get you back and talk about that because, you know, I was hearing, it's the retails, the Wall Street Bets pumping up silver from 26 to 29. I'm saying, no, it's not Wall Street Bets. It's Hendry. I know.
and behind me, I got some really talented people. I mean, the things, the analysis that I kind of purported to tell you come from my old investment partner, Thomas Roderick, who runs a hedge fund now out there, a micro hedge fund, and doing very, very well with it. And the last leading shout wouldn't necessarily be silver. It would be owning industrial metals. But the mining stocks, with the whole globalization or reverse globalization, there's a premium today from owning stateside or Canadian and US assets. Those are the ones that have got the stronger beta to the upside for many other reasons that we could discuss.
Because of political stability reasons?
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Well, Hugh, thanks so much. You've been very generous with your time. Thanks, and hope to have you back on
the alarm. We're doing 15 minutes, baby.
15 minutes, yeah.
We did it. Boom.
All right.
Dumb.
Thanks, Hugh.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Now, with the market plumbing, we're going to go to Weston Nakamura. Weston, how are you doing?
Hey, Jack. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. So you made a post in the exchange about some dislocations you saw in the VIX futures markets. The VIX, commonly known as the fear index, which gauges the implied volatility on various options contracts. What was it you noticed? And tell us about this. Why is it significant?
Sure. Just before I say that, the VIX is no longer the fear gauge. The VIX is the greed gauge. This has actually been brought up in Real Vision before, but because of this call skew, there's basically so many calls being bought, it's no longer measuring fear, it's measuring greed. So when there's S&P up and VIX up, it's not necessary. It just means that's actually just in line with greed. But with regards to my note that I posted on the exchange, yeah. So basically last week I said that I noticed that there was a rather huge dislocation between the front month and the second month of VIX. So basically you have, VIX futures and the spot VIX. The spot VIX is like the S&P 500 index. It's not ownable. It's just an index. It's just a number. The futures you can own and trade. And the futures, more or less, they don't deviate from one another too much. But there was a massive, massive dislocation between the March VIX and the February VIX, which expired today. So it was soon to expire. And when that happens, when you have the second month and the front month spread, when that widens out, that dictates the direction of S&P. So when the spread widens, S&P goes up. When it contracts, S&P goes down. And so what I noticed was that because of this huge spread, the February VIX was essentially getting sold down. It was pulling the spot VIX, what you see as, you know, the VIX on the corner of the screen or whatever. It was pulling that level down. That was pushing S&P up. And then today, when the contracts expire and March, the next front month, is five, vol higher, you're going to see a massive spike in VIX, and then you're going to see a potential huge, you know, sharp sell-off in S&P, or at least, you know, the end of the all-time highs rallies. So that's basically what's been happening.
Okay, so what you're saying is that as these February contracts expire, investors are going to have to either get out of that position or roll them up to a level of the VIX that is higher, and that the March VIX will now become the spot, and that will be higher. And tell us, what is the connection? Why, when the VIX increases, why does that mean that the S&P is going to sell off? What's the plumbing there?
Sure. So if you look at the charts, so if you look at this March to Feb spread and the VIX index. So basically what you have is when there's a spread like that, right? When the second month minus the immediate front month, when that second month is lower than the front month, in other words, when there's less uncertainty 2 months out than there is in the immediate, that's gonna cause for a sell-off. That's why that happens. That's the mechanics behind it. When that spread, when the second month minus the front month is negative, that means that there is more uncertainty in the immediate than there is 2 months out. In the immediate, as in, you know, 1 month implied out. And then vice versa, when there is more certainty, like, you know, normal life, when there's more certainty in the immediate than there is 2 months out, you get a directional upside to the index.
Okay. That makes sense. I guess my next question is, where do we go from here? We have the VIX is likely set to rise. It is up today. We did see a sell-off in the S&P 500. Do you expect that to continue? Was this just a one-day phenomenon that you expected, or is this something that we can expect from here on?
So what I was highlighting in my note was like an extreme case scenario where you get something like minus $37 per barrel in crude, which is the exact same sort of setup. So around this time last year, you have USO, which is this oil ETN, which is structured the exact same way. They give oil exposure, they give crude oil exposure to investors by owning the front month and the second month CL crude oil contracts on CME. And what happened was that this oil ETN, USO, they essentially got they got stuck with so many of these soon to expire futures contracts that there was nobody to sell to, and they literally had to sell at minus 37 as their, you know, at $37 per barrel. And that also has to do with because of the fact that they have to take physical delivery. There wasn't enough oil storage. You have to pay to get oil off your hands and all that kind of thing. But the same sort of mechanics apply here, where that kind of structure, and then after that, they now have diversified into more than just the front 2 months. So I think that if you go to the UVX fund flows, that's what caught my attention. So UVXY is the largest VIX ETF in the world, and it took in almost $1 billion in AUM in 1 week alone last week. Very, very strange. And if they don't change their structure the same way that USO did, you could very well see a situation in which you just get these huge inflows the week before expiry, just so, like it was, you know, coming into this one. But and if UVXY is forced to buy a soon to expire VIX contract, you're going to see more and more dislocations between the front month and the second month contract. That's going to dictate the entire S&P, you know, and the U.S. Equity, and the, for that matter, the global DM equity index complex. And it's just going to be dictated directionally day by day by what this this ETF is doing and what their role activity is. And so what's dangerous is that you could have very well have seen a situation in which, you know, if $1 billion came into UVXY in a day, they'll be forced to buy February futures, VIX futures, which then they have to what, roll in the like 45 minutes later, like out of it, and they're going to be selling it to nobody. They're going to push VIX down to like, I don't know, like 10 or something, or in single digits, which is the equivalent of like, you know, minus $37 per barrel of crude. And should that happen, you're going to see an SPX rally of like 10% in a day, followed by a minus 10% the following day, right? And it's just going to be insanity in the markets that have nothing to do with index fundamentals or anything like that, right? So okay. It's incredible power.
Weston, that's what you mean when you say a whiplash, is that you have all of this money coming in, They have to sell the spot price, or they have to sell the front month VIX future as it approaches expiry, pushing that price down and bidding up the other one. That causes the market to surge. But once the expiry actually happens, it surges right back down. So that's what you might buy whipsaw. Up 10%, down 10%, right?
Right. And just the structure of the market, the structure of these ETFs, and the structure of the fact that there are so many funds that are simply just relying on a value at risk, a VAR model, that's simply priced off of the VIX. They have, you know, God knows how many positions and exposures, but they just look at one figure and they say, okay, if VIX is at X, we sell Y. And if VIX is at, you know, Z, we will buy A amount or whatever it is. Then it's just oversimplified. And that's why you get these huge index level, index wide swings on a strong retail figure or whatever it may be that comes out. And then people kind of try to analyze it that way. And, you know, but it's just, it's totally become a mechanical market in every way, in risk management, in fund structures, in passive fund structures, and in everything.
Mechanical indeed. Well, Weston, as we close out this daily briefing, you know, this is one of the very interesting things that you posted this on the exchange. There's so much more on the exchange. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So we actually just released our February edition of Inside the Hive Mind of the Real Vision Exchange. It's basically a monthly publication of what's going on within the exchange. This past month, it's backwards looking, but this past month in January was the most significant month for individual investors, perhaps in, you know, modern history, certainly, with not just GameStop, but the entire sort of movement of it. We being a social platform of, you know, discussing finance, we are very much relevant to this. Congress, House Financial Services Committee is meeting tomorrow discussing this with the CEO of Robinhood and all that. This is very, very topical. This is very relevant. I suggest everyone go to Real Vision's, the Real Vision Exchange. You can find it on my page, Wes Nakamura. Download it, read it, and it's really good insight. And you can tap into the hive mind of the Real Vision Exchange.
Absolutely. If you like what Weston had to say, and just know that he is the king of the hive mind. He's the king bee. So you get all that honey in the hive mind.
There are no kings. There are no kings. There are no. I'm not a queen bee. We're all worker bees. We're all contributing bees.
There we go. Well, Weston, I think this is your second time on the daily briefing, right?
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Well, we have to have you on more often. It's always great to talk to you.
Indeed. Thank you so much.